because the platform given to the prominent far-right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, I know there's a, I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that, the work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is this merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get, because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going to win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
In the limelight.
The U.S. infrastructure is not built to a standard that protects against the level of flood risk people face today, let alone how those risks will grow over the next 30 years as the climate changes, said one expert. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Quarter of All Critical U.S. Infrastructure at Risk from Flooding, a report says. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Underscoring the need to slash greenhouse gas emissions and invest in public goods to better prepare communities across the United States for escalating extreme weather, a new report released recently finds that one quarter of the U.S. critical infrastructure is already susceptible to flooding that renders it inaccessible, with risks projected to increase in the coming decades. Described as the first ever nationwide evaluation of community-level vulnerability to flooding, the report, Infrastructure on the Brink, compiled by the First Street Foundation, a nonprofit research group that specializes in environmental risk assessment, highlights localities where housing, commercial real estate, transportation networks, schools, hospitals, power plants, and other pieces of infrastructure face operational flood risk in 2021. The analysis also explores how spatial patterns of flood risk are expected to change over the next 30 years as the fossil fuel-driven climate emergency exacerbates sea level rise and extreme rainfall events, which pose direct and indirect threats to the safety and well-being of people throughout the U.S. The report states it is clear now more than ever that the ways and places in which we live are likely to continue to be impacted by our changing environment. One of the most important implications in this development is the vulnerability of the national infrastructure in the U.S. Using a unique national database that contains parcel-level flood risk information combining hazards, exposure, and vulnerability, as well as over 20,000 flood adaptation measures, the report maps Americans' current and future flood risks based on their proximity to coasts and floodplains, plus the estimated impacts of flood-damaged infrastructure at the broader scales of neighborhoods, zip codes, cities, and counties. As the authors note, individuals whose homes were spared the impact of a particular flood event are increasingly likely to find their local roads, businesses, critical infrastructure, utilities, or emergency services affected. The report assesses risk to residential properties, roads, commercial properties, critical infrastructure, including airports, fire stations, hospitals, police stations, ports, power stations, Superfund hazardous waste sites, water outfalls and wastewater treatment facilities, and social infrastructure, including government buildings, historic buildings, houses of worship, museums, and schools. Defining risk as the unique level of flooding for each infrastructure type relative to operational thresholds, the report finds risk to residential properties is expected to increase by 10% over the next 30 years, with 12.4 million properties at risk today and 13.6 million at risk of flooding in 2051. 2 million miles of road are at risk today, and that is expected to increase to 2.2 million miles of road over the next 30 years. Commercial properties are expected to see a 7% increase in risk of flooding from 2021 to 2051, with 918,540 at risk today and 984,051 at risk of flooding in 30 years. Currently, 35,776 critical infrastructure facilities are at risk today, increasing to 37,786 facilities by 2051, a 6% increase in risk. And compounding that risk, 71,717 pieces of social infrastructure facilities are at risk today, increasing to 77,843 by 2051, an increase of 9% over that time period. The report comes in the wake of several highly destructive flooding events that affected various parts of the U.S. this summer, including one in Tennessee in August, as well as the inundation of New York City's subway system in July and again in September during Hurricane Ida. Deadly and costly disasters that exposed how ill-prepared the U.S. is to reduce extreme weather-related infrastructure damage and the ensuing consequences. The new analysis also points to earlier catastrophes such as Hurricane Sandy, which hit the New York City metropolitan area in 2012 and flooded hospitals, crippled electrical substations, overwhelmed wastewater treatment centers, and shut down power and water to tens of millions of people. The U.S. infrastructure is not built to a standard that protects against the level of flood risk Americans face today. let alone how those risks will grow over the next 30 years as the climate changes. Matthew Ebbe, founder and executive director of the First Street Foundation, said in a statement, adding, "This report highlights the cities and counties whose vital infrastructure are most at risk today and will help inform where investment dollars should flow in order to best mitigate against that risk." According to the report, there are significant differences at the county and city level in amount of risk that exists today and into the future. Most importantly, there are a group of counties and cities that have persistent patterns of vulnerability across multiple dimensions of physical risk from flooding. These areas tend to be in regions with well-established flood risk, such as coastal floodplains along the Gulf and southeastern coast of the U.S., but also in less well-known flood zones, such as in Appalachian mountain regions of West Virginia and Kentucky. To that point, 17 of the top 20 counties in the U.S., which are most at risk, that is about 85%, are in the states of Louisiana, Florida, West Virginia, and Kentucky. Additionally, the top cities at risk of flooding persistently show up in the states of Louisiana, Florida, Texas, and South Carolina. The analysis further uncovered a high degree of vulnerability in some of the major population centers in the U.S., including New Orleans, Miami, Tampa, Charleston, Chicago, and Los Angeles.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام تذاكر العلم ساعة خير من قيام ليلة.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Revising knowledge for an hour is better than staying up the whole night in worship."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has beautiful conversations, and we find that in some of these conversations between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and his companions or his friends or his family members or his relatives or even the people in general, we find that Imam al-Baqir talks about morals and ethics, these Islamic codes of conduct, but really they are profound in the depth of their wisdom and their knowledge. And so when asked about modesty and faith by one of his companions, we find that in this discussion, Imam al-Baqir continues and explains this relationship between modesty and faith. He says to his companion, "Modesty and faith are coupled with each other. If one of them goes away, the other will follow it." A very beautiful statement here in this conversation by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Of course, where he is saying that modesty and faith are coupled with each other. They are connected with each other. If one of them goes away, the other will follow. So, meaning, if modesty leaves, faith will also leave. And likewise, if faith leaves, modesty will also leave. Dear friends, this is truly a very profound statement. And the more you think about it, really, the more the truth of this statement becomes apparent. So, for example, modesty, this lifestyle of being modest, whether it's modest in the material things that we own, modesty in our speaking, modesty in our dressing, modesty in our behaviors, modesty in our speech, all of these are different forms and types of modesty. If we have this kind of modesty, then faith will enter into our hearts. If we don't have this modesty, if we lie, if we cheat, if we live a very extravagant life, if we dressed immodestly, you know, these things will take faith away from us. And likewise, if we have faith, this iman, this belief in God, this belief in obeying God, this belief, this faith in preventing ourselves from the disobedience of God, of course, leads to modesty, and modesty in all its different facets. Dear friends, this is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
So our Imam, Baqir Ulum al-Nabiyyin, it's interesting that our, you know, Muslim historians, when they talk about our Imams, they always praise them for their piety, for that their knowledge. And there is no issue there where they acknowledge their greatness as far as knowledge is concerned. But it's interesting to see that they do not make up stories about who were the teachers of these imams. You know, all our other figures, the Sahaba, the companions, the scholars, A'imma of Fiqh and Kalam and Hadith, you have this whole biography of them talking about who were their teachers. When it comes to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam or Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, at the most you will see that they will say his father was his teacher. But they didn't learn from anyone else. Because we believe that they are, according to the ayat of Quran, one of the famous ayat, وَجَعَلْنَا مِنْهُ أَئِمَّةً, where Allah says, I have made them imams, يَهْدُونَ بِأَمْرِنَا, they guide people according to our command. And so whatever they have, the knowledge that they gain comes from Rasulullah and the imams who came before. And also Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala constantly guides them so that whenever issues come up, they are able to give the best of solution for the problems of the people. And their knowledge is not restricted to religious matters. It is not that they are only experts in fiqh or hadith or theology. Any issue, even worldly matters, when people come and ask them, they are able to respond to it and give the best of advice. This evening, I would like to talk about one of the important achievements of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, as far as the issue of economic independence gained by the Muslims for the first time in history of Islam. There were no G8, G20, maybe there were only G2. You know, you had this emerging Muslim power in the Middle East, Arab area, with one empire on the west and another empire on the east. The Eastern Roman Empire, covering Syria, Egypt, Palestine, Turkey, and then you have the Eastern, the area where you have the Sassanid Persian Empire, covering both sides of the Persian Gulf, as well as, of course, Iran was the headquarters, and even Iraq was under it. And so there were two powers there when Islam emerged on the scene. And those days, the trade and business basically was done on a barter form. And the coins used by Muslims till the days of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam were the coins of the Eastern Roman Empire and the Persian Sassanid Empire. So the gold coins came from the Roman Empire, known as dinar, and the silver coins came from the Persian Empire, known as dirham. And this is where you see the influence that they had, although these were the currencies even used by Muslims during their early stage of forming their own empire. Gradually, of course, you know, the Muslims during the time of the Khulafa, they conquered Sham, the greater Syria, including Palestine and Egypt. So these are the areas which were under the control of the Eastern Roman Empire, now conquered by the Muslims. And then Iran and Iraq is also conquered by the Muslims, and these are the provinces of the Persian Sassanid Empire. And so that's where you see even the currency is more becoming more part of the mainstream Muslim market. One of the things which were from the legacy of the Eastern Roman Empire in Egypt was this manufacture of paper. Egypt was known to be the main source in the Middle East if you wanted to buy paper. And because it was controlled by the Eastern Roman Empire from early days, even after Muslims conquered that land, you know, many of the things were still being done as in past.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of protesters rallied in support of the European Union across Poland on Sunday. Organizers said the demonstrations were held in more than 100 Polish towns and cities and several cities abroad. The demonstrators were angry at the controversial court ruling issued on Thursday that raised concerns the country might eventually leave the EU. But unlike the United Kingdom, whose people voted to leave the EU in the 2016 Brexit referendum, opinion polls show a majority of Poles want their country to remain in the bloc. The demonstrations were called by former EU chief Donald Tusk, now the leader of the country's main opposition grouping, Civic Platform. Speaking to a large crowd in Warsaw, he called on people to defend European Poland. Poland's Constitutional Tribunal ruled on Thursday that some provisions of the EU treaties and court rulings are incompatible with the Polish constitution. The ruling essentially rejects the primacy of EU law over national legislation.
Essentially, it's a constitutional contest as to whose law is supreme, the EU's law or Poland's law. And actually, the policy in both cases is actually unclear. Poland's constitution is supreme, except that it must conform with EU policy regarding judicial independence and other such issues. And the Kaczynski government in Poland is determined to crack down on judicial independence. So there seems to be a collision taking place.
The move was the latest event escalating the tensions in the ties between Brussels and Warsaw since the right-wing Law and Justice Party came to power in Poland in 2015. After winning the presidential and parliamentary elections in 2015, the Law and Justice Party started implementing changes to Poland's judicial system. The country's new president, Andrzej Duda, replaced several constitutional judge appointees by the previous government with those supported by the ruling party. The move, the European Union argues, breached Polish laws. The ruling PIS then moved to establish a disciplinary chamber to penalize judges who otherwise enjoy broad protection from political or parliamentary influence. It argued that the chamber was needed to hold judges accountable and purge the judiciary from the remnants of the communist-era judges who are still serving in the country. The move was rejected by the EU as incompatible with European law. In December 2020, EU members unanimously agreed to link respect for the rule of law to the access of EU funds. Among the 27 member states, Hungary and Poland agreed to the measure only if they were allowed to challenge it at the Luxembourg-based court. The rule of law mechanism is putting tens of billions of dollars in European aid to Poland at risk, as the bloc contends that the country no longer has an independent judiciary system.
But the problem is that in the case of the Federation, it's not really clear who's in charge, who's really dominant. And so there's a contest of wills. And if you ask whether the EU is overextended, the answer is probably yes. I mean, the EU has lost Britain, obviously. Italy is heading off in an increasingly dangerous and fascistic direction, which is very threatening to the EU's core mission. And countries like Poland, Hungary, and the Baltics are in open revolt against the EU. And it's not clear that the EU can make its authority felt in those areas.
Poland is arguing that the European laws are infringing on its sovereignty, something that the Polish authorities aren't expected to take lightly. The issue is, how far does Brussels want to push things, and whether that would lead to the Union losing another member?
It was an attack that killed dozens. The death toll could be around 150. A bombing at a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz during the Friday prayers. It was the worst attack since the Taliban took over control in August. All victims of the attack were Hazara Shias. Their community has been targeted by repression and violence in Afghanistan for decades now. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the suicide attack. Daesh has repeatedly targeted the Shia community across Afghanistan in the past. Experts believe this recent attack targeting the Kunduz mosque served several purposes for Daesh. One of their goals could be attempts to undermine the Taliban's newly established government. The other could be to continue their long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15-20% of the country's population. The tragic incident drew condemnations from Iranian officials. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, condemned the attack, calling on Afghan officials to punish the perpetrators. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Afghan authorities to take measures to prevent such terrorist acts. Also, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi voiced concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan. He stated that the growth of the Daesh terror group has been a U.S. job and that Washington has supported this group in Afghanistan. Also, in a Sunday phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron, Raisi said the world must hold the United States to account for supporting terrorism fomented by Daesh Takfir Group and other new forms of this ominous phenomenon. In addition, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf condemned the attack, warning that the Afghan nation's enemies seek to stoke ethnic and religious discord in the country by using terrorists, who are backed by the United States. Also, Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the attack, saying Islamic nations and the international community have left the Afghan people alone. He called on Afghans to strengthen their national unity and solidarity and take steps to protect civilians from Daesh terrorists.
We know it's very clear that Daesh is supported by the U.S. and the Zionists. We've seen how they tried to disrupt Iraq and Syria and try to cause a major stabilization in these two countries. Luckily, there was strong resistance and unified resistance and a unified force to defeat Daesh and destroy them fully and eradicate them from the area.
In a message on Saturday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Afghanistan's authorities to punish the perpetrators behind the Friday terrorist attack targeting worshippers at a packed Shia mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The bitter, tragic incident involving a blast at the mosque of Khanabad district of Kunduz province, which resulted in the deaths of a large number of faithful worshippers, saddened us. Authorities in the neighboring and brotherly country of Afghanistan are seriously expected to punish the bloodthirsty perpetrators of this heinous crime and take necessary measures to prevent a recurrence of such tragedies. In fact, Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for several attacks in Afghanistan in recent weeks. This has put the Taliban under pressure because the newly formed rule vowed to provide safety for Afghans when it took power in August. Therefore, the Taliban has vowed to find and punish the perpetrators. They also have destroyed a cell belonging to Daesh terror group in the capital, Kabul, recently.
You know, we're hoping that the Taliban will make the right moves and treat this as a terrorist attack on its people. And this obviously shows a sign of weakness for the Taliban if they do not prosecute these criminals and these terrorists. And it shows that there is an open door, an open hand to, attack people inside Afghanistan. And that show a bad sign for Afghanistan's new administration. So if they really want to show, strength, and they want to show unity, and they want to show that they are in control, they must prosecute these criminals, and also to stop further attacks like this that could cause sectarian problems as well in the whole region.
Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai had once said in an interview that the U.S. is colluding with Daesh in Afghanistan and allowing the Takfiris to flourish in the conflict-stricken country. In addition, many U.S. officials have confessed to Washington being responsible for Daesh's creation. Now that this unholy child of Washington's flawed policies in Middle East is causing trouble, it's likely that we are going to see a major confrontation between Daesh and the Taliban in near future. Britain grapples with a full-blown crisis. Labor shortages, truck drivers in particular, have disrupted supply chain activities and caused several problems. The significant lack of drivers meant deliveries of fuel and food were falling short. As a result, the country witnessed panic buying of fuel and some goods dwindled. These events triggered chaotic scenes across major cities, leading to long lines at gas stations and fistfights among drivers. Also, many factories and businesses are struggling with rising energy bills. They are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. In fact, the crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. The British government is now under fire for its handling of the crisis. So, being under intense pressure, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the trucking industry for Britain's supply chain mess. The industry called Johnson's claims wrong and pointed to the government's immigration policy and delays in testing and certifying new drivers as the main culprits. The government also claimed there is a global shortage of drivers. However, the European countries have not faced a similar problem. Britain faces a shortfall of 100,000 drivers. 20% of those are drivers who departed Britain after the country voted to leave the European Union. In addition, about 200,000 EU citizens left Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. So, how does the British government address the crisis? By introducing a short-term visa program. But by offering short-term visas to foreign truckers, the British government is admitting that exiting the EU was a decisive factor in the current crisis. In addition, many people are reluctant to uproot themselves and move to Britain for temporary and difficult work while they have better options in EU member state countries.
It's a crisis of the free market, a triumph of the free market. The government's abandoned regulation, it's abandoned public ownership, so it's private ownership. So we're depending for energy in Britain on people who make lots of profits out of energy shortages. So, if it's to someone's advantage to see gas and electricity prices shoot up, then they're going to go up. They're not going to say, oh, we're not going to take profits because it's bad for the economy. They're going to say, hey, send me more.
Households that spend a high proportion of their income on energy bills are considered to be in fuel poverty. Currently, 4 million people in Britain are already in fuel poverty, while up to 1.5 additional British households won't be able to afford to heat and power their homes. Last October, the government raised the energy price cap to control the sharply rising wholesale gas prices. The cap limits the impact of soaring energy prices on British households. The UK energy regulator said that the price cap must rise again next year if wholesale gas prices continue to go up. This could mean a typical customer paying between £400 and £600 more annually. That's while natural gas prices are at record highs as economies around the world begin to recover from the COVID crisis.
The government in Britain has recently cut back on the minimum payments for welfare and support for all sorts of people, from unemployed to underpaid to pensioners. So a lot of the apparatus that was very leaky, the very leaky safety net we already had in Britain has been torn up, and the government has decided that people, as a matter of conscious policy, they think that people only go to work if they're starving, so they're trying to starve people. And that includes freezing them. Freezing and starving will get them to work, is what they think.
The price rises had already pushed 500,000 more households into fuel poverty. Unable to pay heating and energy costs, these low-income families are at a great risk. Many actually die every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. In fact, 8,500 people died in England and Wales last winter due to cold homes. All in all, the British government should stop blaming others and start cleaning up the mess it is responsible for.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And when we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's Counterintelligence Mission Center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
In the limelight.
The humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders has recently unveiled a new report estimating that the United States is hoarding nearly 500 million excess coronavirus vaccine doses, the most of any country, as poor nations across the globe remain without sufficient access to life-saving shots. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Reckless, Doctors Without Borders slams U.S. for hoarding 500 million vaccine doses. Stay tuned for more. The humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders unveiled a new report recently estimating that the United States of America is hoarding nearly 500 million excess coronavirus vaccine doses, the most of any country, as poor nations across the globe remain without sufficient access to life-saving shots. It's reckless and dangerous for the U.S. and other high-income countries to be sitting on excessive stocks of COVID-19 vaccines while others are desperate to provide their most vulnerable people with even their first dose. Dr. Carrie Teicher, Director of Programs at Doctors Without Borders USA, said in a statement, arguing that the Biden administration's hoarding of doses calls into question its claim to be a global leader on COVID-19. The longer people everywhere remain unprotected, the more lives will be lost, and the more likely it is that new and potentially deadlier variants will take hold, said Teicher. The U.S. must immediately make public and concrete commitments to redistribute excess COVID-19 vaccines globally if it truly wants to end this pandemic. To date, the Biden administration has pledged to donate roughly 1.1 billion surplus coronavirus vaccine doses to low-income countries, a commitment that public health campaigners have criticized as badly inadequate to meet global needs. According to the State Department, the U.S. has shipped around 177 million vaccine donations thus far. The World Health Organization has estimated that in order to vaccinate at least 70% of the global population by next year, 11 billion doses equitably distributed will be necessary. Doctors Without Borders, known internationally as Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, said recently that even while factoring in third-dose boosters for high-risk groups, high-income countries are hoarding an estimated 870 million excess doses, including nearly 500 million in the U.S. alone. The rapid redistribution of these doses to low- and middle-income countries could save nearly 1 million lives by mid-2022, the group said. In addition to immediately redistributing vaccine doses globally and demanding vaccine technology, the U.S. must remain committed and urge all countries to support the TRIPS waiver proposal at the World Trade Organization to waive intellectual property monopolies on all COVID-19 products during the pandemic. Public Citizen President Robert Weizmann noted in a statement that all African countries combined have had roughly 150 million doses administered. Africa has a population of over 1.34 billion. The U.S. population is 330 million, Weizmann said. But put it simply, Africa has four times the population of the U.S., but has administered about one-third the number of COVID vaccine doses. This unconscionable vaccine apartheid is not just leaving billions of people in African and other developing countries vulnerable to preventable disease, suffering, and death. It is dramatically increasing global poverty rates, as well as the death, disease, and hunger that accompany severe poverty. In its report recently, Doctors Without Borders warned that millions of doses could be tragically wasted if HICs, or high-income countries, do not immediately redistribute excess doses. G7 and EU countries alone could waste 241 million doses by the end of 2021, the group estimated, adding. Still, pharmaceutical companies continue to prioritize high-profit sales to HICs over a fairer distribution of vaccines. Teacher of Doctors Without Borders said recently that the COVID-19 vaccine inequity that pharma has created by putting profits before people's health is nothing short of shameful. In addition to developing a concrete dose redistribution timeline, by the end of October, the U.S. government must demand vaccine companies to share their technology and know-how, Teacher added. Sharing these technologies will increase the global production and supply of COVID-19 vaccines, saving lives in this pandemic and in the future.
Said Hakim was amongst the Maraji' that was standing against the oppression in Iraq especially. Of course, his activities was not limited only to Iraq. He was worrying about Shia community all over the world.
When we study his lifestyle, we see he was really capable of teaching advanced level. Why? Because he was given this chance to revise the book of Mustamsak al-Urwat al-Wuthqa. By whom? By the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists, especially the Shiite ones, all across the Nation of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahdavi, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, let's continue it on the is called The Life of Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim, one of the greatest maraja in the country Iraq and the Shiite world. On September 3rd, 2021, we missed this outstanding man, this outstanding Shia maraja among the most outstanding students of Sayyid al-Khoi. Let's get to the scholar life of this man, Sheikh Ziyaniya. What details can you give us about him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim was amongst the first figures that we mentioned regarding the scholarship in fiqh and usul in Iraq.
Yes.
He was amongst the students of late marhum Khoui,
yes,
rahmatullah alayhi. And after the demise of late marhum Khoui, the position of marja'iyat was mentioned for marhum Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim. And, you know, maybe it's interesting for us that some of his books was produced in prison.
Oh.
You know, while he was in prison, he decided to compile and write some books. Of course, he didn't have access,
yes,
to, you know, to the sources and to the resources. So he just, relying on his mind,
oh,
decided to write some books. That amongst these books is Al-Muhkam fi Usul al-Fiqh. Of course, he completed this book after coming out from prison.
That's
but
right.
The idea of the writing this book and some other books came to his mind while he was in prison for 8 years.
8 years by Saddam Hussein Abbas regime.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, so Saddam Hussein, the chief of the Ba'ath regime of the time of Iraq, decided to hold a seminar and invited all the scholars in Iraq, amongst which was Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim, rahmatullah alayhi, and he didn't participate in that seminar.
Yes. As a sign of opposition to Saddam Hussein.
Yes, yes,
okay,
yes. They threatened him.
Yes.
And they said that if you do not participate, we will put problems on your way. But he insisted on not participating in that, you know, gathering.
Yes.
And the gathering was to give mashru'iyat and legitimacy to the government of Saddam.
Yes.
That's why he didn't participate in that program. And, you know, he was to back the government of Iran that on those times,
yes,
was the, you know, government that was defending Shia school,
yes,
of thought against the Ba'ath regime.
Yes.
So Ayatollah Hakim was amongst the four main scholars in Najaf that when you want to mention the great scholars of Najaf, one of them is Sayyid al-Sistani, Hafadahullah,
yes,
Ayatollah Bashir al-Najafi, and Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim. These are the great figures here.
Yes.
So one of the most important points regarding his personality that is based on the, you know, scholarship personage,
yes,
is that Ayatollah Hakim was one of the defenders of muqawamat,
mm-hmm,
defensive of Shiites in Iraq.
Yes.
You know, if a prominent scholar stands for the people who are fighting against oppression, this is completely different with the situation that someone who is not a prominent one, he is just talking about the issue and,
yes,
no one listens to him.
No practical,
yes,
yeah, no encounter.
For example, after the attack of ISIS, we all,
yes,
are aware of the famous fatwa of Sayyid Sistani, Hafadahullah,
yes,
regarding jihad.
Yes.
And Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Said al-Hakim was amongst those scholars who backed this,
yes,
fatwa.
Very good.
And they said that we all back Sayyid Sistani and,
yes,
we are defending those people who participate in this, you know, al-Hashd al-Sha'bi and stand against the,
yes,
ISIS in the
That's
battle.
All right. Thank you very much. Truly a practical marja who is concerned with all the socio-political and religious affairs of the society. And this is what the, we can say, the Muslim community and the Shia community expect from the maraja, you know, to be active in the society and to be concerned with the affairs of the people. Alhamdulillah, this is so in the Islamic seminaries of Qom, Najaf, Mashhad, and Karbala. And we could see the students, you know, and the next generation of this maraja and their roles in nurturing the students and the people. Let's get to the other works of Sayyid al-Hakim. Sheikh Mahtabi, can you name some of them for us?
Yes, sir. A lot of works, more than 24,
titles have been authored by late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sayyid al-Hakim, and this is because of his talent in the fiqh and usul. This is mentioned that when he was 32, he reached the level that he was teaching advanced level of fiqh usul, which is called Dars-e Kharij-e Fiqh Usul. And we know